Strict limits on unilateral presidential power. While President Trump has forsworn daily briefings, he will undoubtedly hear his national security advisor let him know of the latest looming threats by terrorist networks lurking somewhere in this great land of ours. These threats should never be enough for him to trigger a state of emergency. Instead, only an actual attack on the scale of September 11 creates the distinctive second strike problem that justifies extraordinary action. The problem is simply this. On the one hand, the major attack has taken the security services by surprise. Otherwise, they would have seized the key actors in the terrorist network. On the other hand, the fact that the terrorists have managed to pull off a major attack vastly increases the risk that they are in a position to follow up with a second attack, unless decisive steps are taken immediately to preempt the threat. Putting both hands together, the emergency rationale goes like this. Given the ignorance of the security forces, the only way to minimize the chances of a second strike is to detain terrorist suspects on the basis of reasonable suspicion, rather than the higher standards required for a criminal prosecution. If they must convince judges that they have probable cause to target particular terrorists, this will give the network enough time to strike again and escalate the panic further, eroding public confidence that the crisis will ever end. The common sense case for a state of emergency is, then, compelling. But it comes with the common sense caveat. There is every reason to expect that the security agencies will systematically abuse the extraordinary powers they have been granted. Since they are unable to pinpoint the key actors in the terrorist network, they will be obliged to rely on watch lists they have prepared before the event, which identify tens of thousands of Americans who have been identified as potentially involved in problematic activities. As a consequence, the only way they can disrupt the terrorist network in the short term is to use these watch lists as the basis for massive detentions. Yet while such a step might or might not be effective, only one thing is clear. Most of the prisoners behind bars will be entirely innocent. Given these obvious risks, Trump should be authorized to act unilaterally only for the time it takes for Congress to consider whether a state of emergency is truly justified, say a week or two. Unless the president can persuade a majority of both chambers to approve his initial declaration, the state of emergency should immediately lapse. Even if they do approve, this vote should be valid for only 2 months, and the matter should then return to Congress to determine whether conditions have sufficiently returned to normal to require the security services to establish that they have probable cause for each and every one of their arrests. On the second round of reappraisal, moreover, it shouldn't be enough for a simple majority to go along with Trump's demands for further anti-terrorist sweeps. The president must persuade a supermajority of 60% of both chambers that extraordinary measures are justified. This supermajoritarian threshold should continue to increase with further presidential requests. When Trump returns after 2 more months, he must gain a 70% majority, and he will confront an 80% threshold every time he returns for a further renewal. This supermajoritarian escalator puts the ongoing exercise of emergency power in control of the minority party in Congress, precisely the group that will be especially alive to the danger that Trump will use his extraordinary powers to further his political ambitions. Especially as Election Day approaches, they will be especially skeptical of presidential requests for renewal. Unless, of course, the terrorist network is continuing to wreak havoc. Rather than depending on judges as the principal check on the abuse of presidential power, the new statute should rely on the political branches to play a central role in creating a democratic system of checks and balances. Yet courts will also have critical oversight functions to play. As we have seen, the emergency statute should authorize short-term detention on reasonable suspicion, without insisting on probable cause. But given the probable innocence of most of those swept into prison, this is only acceptable on a short-term basis. Once a suspect has been held, say, for 45 days, the government can continue his confinement only by presenting evidence in court of a kind generally required for this purpose. Moreover, even at the beginning of the emergency 45-day period, the security services must inform the court of the reasons why their targets have acted suspiciously, detailing the data provided in their watch lists with appropriate provisions for confidentiality. It should never be enough simply to lock a person up on the arbitrary hunch by somebody or other in the security hierarchy. Similarly, the statute should provide for an independent civilian authority, supervised by the courts, to prevent torture and other inhumane techniques at detention centers. But it is not enough to rely on proactive measures by judges and civilian watchdogs during the emergency. The statute should also grant financial compensation to everybody whose fundamental rights have been abused by the emergency sweeps. This includes, most obviously, detainees who have been thrown into jail on the basis of an arbitrary hunch. It should include also the mass of individuals whose names have appeared on watch lists, but who are never charged with the crime in connection with the attack. They have not only sacrificed their personal liberty for the public good. While trapped in overcrowded cells, they may well have lost their jobs and generated traumatic anxiety among their families and friends. This is fundamentally wrong. The statute should instead provide all innocent victims of the emergency a weekly payment of $3,000, three times the median weekly income for an American family. This award will not only respond to their material losses, it will also help them deal with the stigma that will otherwise be associated with the fact of their incarceration. By paying them generous compensation, the government will be demonstrating that these victims of the watch list should not be treated as presumptive terrorists by the rest of society, but that they have instead been called to sacrifice their personal lives as part of a broader effort by American citizens to sustain their republic at a challenging moment in its history. I first proposed a state of emergency regime in the immediate aftermath of September 11. And my initiative generated a broad-ranging discussion that has had some practical impact both here and abroad. But more recently, serious attention to the problem has declined, and this essay is an attempt to revive the conversation. Much that was said during the first round of debate remains important. Clarifying critical issues of statutory design, as well as fundamental questions dealing with the place of emergency legislation in the larger constitutional order. But I hope that I have persuaded you that recent events have made it more, not less, imperative to confront these questions once again. In placing emergency legislation back on the action agenda, we will be redeeming a tradition that goes back to the Philadelphia Convention. In writing the original Constitution, the founders paid very little attention to the nature and scope of fundamental rights, leaving it to the first Congress to fill this gap with a series of amendments. But they made an exception when it came to states of emergency, which they treated in a fashion that parallels the dualistic approach taken here. On the one hand, Article 1 insists that the guarantee against arbitrary arrest and conviction is indeed foundational. On the other, it recognizes that emergency conditions may justify temporary limitations. To put this dualism in the founders' words, the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when, in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. The 18th century language invites us to reflect more deeply on our 21st century problem. As I have emphasized, it is of high importance to limit emergency powers to those occasions on which a terrorist organization has successfully engaged in an attack on the scale of September 11. In terms of the founding text, I suggest that such an act of organized violence represents a modern-day version of rebellion, in which the extremist group, either secular or religious, seeks to overthrow the very foundations of our constitutional democracy. Our 21st century challenge is to respond in the spirit of the founders and adapt the principles of checks and balances so that emergency powers may be invoked when the public safety may require it. At that same time, we must prevent the exercise of extraordinary authority from destroying the very constitutional order the Declaration of Emergency purports to protect. Are we equal to the challenge? Another Road to Serfdom. Cascading Intolerance. Timur Kuran. In one of the most influential books of the 20th century, The Road to Serfdom, Friedrich Hayek warned against the dangers of state control over the economy. He was writing during World War II, a time when collectivists on the left were extinguishing private property, and those on the right were empowering the state with expanding rights of ownership and management. The horrors of Stalin, Hitler, and Mussolini were widely apparent. These were not aberrations caused by madmen, argued Hayek. Rather, they resulted from placing undue faith in the capacity of government to engineer utopia. Although the democracies fighting these regimes were, by and large, free of the conditions that produced collectivist horrors, that was no reason for complacency. The United States could institute tyranny inadvertently, through well-intended calls on government to solve social problems. There is another road to serfdom, whose fount is not collectivist economic ideology. Although it may culminate in resource centralization, its starting point is the selective suppression of communications. The suppression comes from leaders harboring undue faith in their own sense of the good society, or from citizens who entrust leaders with extensive powers to direct the right messages. To block ostensibly harmful acts and expressions, such efforts at control limit the free exchange of ideas. One consequence of their vigilance is the distortion of knowledge in the public domain. Another is the curtailment of social experimentation, which depends on the sharing of thoughts. Limits on expression also impoverish people's understandings of social processes. Politicians exploit the resulting combustion of hostility, panic, and ignorance through policies that may seem responsive to grievances, but are ultimately counterproductive. By pandering to intolerant constituents and stoking fear and anger, they enable the rise of a leader with autocratic ambitions. Using state resources, that leader may then reinforce and deepen the prejudices instrumental in his own ascent. Vladimir Putin of Russia and Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey offer cases in point. Each identified and then exploited strains of intolerance to solidify political and economic power, ultimately using his followers' sense of victimization to stoke hostility toward anyone who stood in his way. The victims of such tactics include people who, by helping to cleanse public discourse, galvanize the very processes responsible for turning legitimate democratic power into dictatorship. Donald Trump's meteoric rise to power has advanced certain preconditions of a similarly autocratic regime in the United States. But could the world's most powerful country really become a dictatorship? The American political system incorporates checks and balances designed to protect individual liberties, sustain the coexistence of lifestyles, and keep groups from acting on intolerance. These safeguards came into play as soon as Trump took power and began issuing executive orders. His successive Muslim bans of early 2017, which suspended visits from certain majority Muslim countries, were blocked by courts until the Supreme Court allowed the partial implementation of a tempered version. Several of his aides with suspected ties to authoritarian governments were forced to resign, and Congress is investigating the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. When in August 2017 he failed to condemn violence by white supremacists, he was widely denounced by a very wide spectrum of leaders, including top officials of his own party. Nevertheless, The effectiveness of American democratic institutions cannot be taken for granted. For one thing, intolerance may make people rationalize selective suspensions of constitutional and political protections. For another, the very fact of Trump's electoral success points to systemic vulnerabilities of which he is more a symptom than a cause. If Trump were to disappear from American politics, sliding toward dictatorship would remain a danger. Another person with contempt for democratic values and procedures, Republican, Democrat, or independent, could capture the presidency through support from intolerant constituents. Intolerant communities. Whereas in Hayek's feared trajectory, liberties are lost because of government expansion, in the present case, the engine of illiberalism is communities situated in civil society, the portion of the social system outside of direct government control. These communities include associations similar to those that Alexis de Tocqueville considered vital to American democracy. Sustained primarily by shared interests, these associations constrain individual behaviors by promoting common understandings of right and wrong. They also limit what individuals may say or do to each other with impunity. Intolerant communities differ from idealized Tocquevillian associations partly in degree, then. They are communities whose hallmark is an unusually strong sense of proper behavior. They differ in kind because of their self-righteous determination to hold outsiders to their own standards, which they consider above criticism. Insofar as they get involved in politics, intolerant communities threaten democratic governance. They lay the foundations for tyranny by creating constituencies prepared to suspend the rule of law for some higher purpose. Intolerant communities thrive in the presence of other intolerant communities, especially those intolerant of them. They exclude aggressively because they themselves are excluded. They hate because they are hated. They censor because their own views are dismissed, mocked, and suppressed. Clashes between intolerant communities undermine freedom of association, extinguish individualities, and incapacitate democratic institutions. Through these channels, they facilitate the rise of dictatorship. Members of an intolerant community do not consider themselves intolerant in any negative sense, because no one is obliged to tolerate intolerance. They define their vigilance not as the denial of others' freedoms, but as drawing boundaries that are essential to human civilization. "We are protecting victims," they will say, or "we are preventing victimization." Just as the highway patrol enforces rules vital to road safety, so, in their own minds, they merely enforce rules that protect the good life for all. Intolerant communities differ, then, from a Tocquevillian association in terms of compatibility between their own self-definition and the definitions of others. In Tocqueville's America, the social functions of a parent-teacher association were not in dispute, and they drew no objections. By contrast, what an intolerant community accomplishes is a matter of huge disagreement, as is its legitimacy. Another possible difference concerns group membership. Unlike the members of a Tocquevillian association, people who identify with an intolerant community do not necessarily recognize themselves as members. Outsiders define their membership, and also ascribe to them motives and influences that may well be spurious. Thus, individuals may be treated as part of an intolerant community simply because of where they work. For instance, a university, or where they live, Appalachia. Disagreements may exist, then, regarding the boundaries of a particular intolerant community. Intolerant communities compete for members through methods akin to those of political parties. Like the propaganda departments of parties, they promote ideologies that focus attention on particular grievances, interpretations of history, and policy instruments. They also provide social status to their members and treat non-members with contempt. Finally, they claim to speak for entire categories of people, women, Christians, when in fact the groups include many who hold very different views. Insofar as an intolerant community is successful, a combination of indoctrination and fear expands its membership. In any given society, multiple intolerant communities may vie for dominance. Often, this competition sustains an equilibrium whereby they coexist in rough balance. As I suggest below, in mid-2017, the polarized politics of the United States exhibits just such an equilibrium. At the most basic level, the U.S. has two intolerant communities, each an alliance of overlapping sub-communities that are divided themselves. Each intolerant community has distinct grievances, worldviews, and justifications for silencing others. No single term does justice to the many motives driving the alliances. Precisely because they do not recognize their own existence, they have no self-adopted names. Given the heterogeneity of these two communities and their diverse internal disagreements, attempts at naming are precarious. But labels offer useful analytic shorthands, provided one keeps in mind what they conceal. On that basis, I shall characterize one community as identitarian and the other as nativist. The identitarian coalition loosely connects groups that define themselves according to some form of identity, mostly gender, ethnicity, or sexual orientation. The nativist coalition encompasses groups suspicious of economic globalization, technological innovation, cultural change, and cross-border labor mobility. In national politics, the identitarians are generally aligned with the left, and the nativists with the right. But neither group defines itself exclusively, or even mainly, in terms of the political spectrum running from left to right. The left-right spectrum dates from the Industrial Revolution, when the principal social conflict concerned the division of economic output between labor and capital. Over time, left and right developed entrenched positions on a wide range of social conflicts. Some of these other conflicts have gained salience through post-industrial technological changes. For identitarians, identity-based matters are more central to the quality of life, and nativists say the same about cultural continuity and the scope of economic freedoms. It is critical that distinct conflicts are involved. The difference makes it harder to achieve compromises than in a system based on the left-right spectrum. Indeed, it is easier to make trade-offs in a single-dimensional space that measures the division of the economic pie than in a multi-dimensional space. Even communication is difficult when adversaries disagree on the nature of the social conflict. Absent a common understanding of what needs to be discussed, no one will gather around a table to sort things out. Our central question can now be restated. Put bluntly, it is whether one of the two intolerant communities might wipe out the other. This would entail the submission of one to the other's wishes by accepting, if only tacitly, its worldview and favored policies. Members of the defeated community would stop expressing their own grievances. They would pretend to share the victor's interpretations of events. Public discourses would reflect the victor's prejudices. They would get saturated with claims that the vanquished community considers contemptible. Observing other societies, one sees that shocks to a social system, business cycles, job-replacing technologies, loss of institutional safeguards, can upset an equilibrium, inducing realignments that then feed on themselves. One type of intolerance starts growing at the expense of the other. Turkey's authoritarian transition exemplifies just such a process. The possibility of an analogous transition in the United States is the question at hand. Identitarian intolerance. The intolerance of American movements based on a sub-identity is widely known as political correctness, a term coined in the 1980s as a pejorative. These movements claim to dignify, protect, and advance constituencies that were, and in many cases remain, underrepresented in certain lucrative and esteemed professions. Originally, the alliance aimed to serve African Americans and other ethnic minorities, women, gays, and lesbians. In the intervening years, the scope of the alliance has expanded. It now includes a broader set of sexual minorities, known as LGBTQAI, and increasingly, also new immigrants from underdeveloped countries. Depending on the context, the presumed malefactors of these sub-identities are whites, males, and heterosexuals. These groups are ostensibly committed, sometimes subconsciously, to safeguarding privileges rooted in history. The identitarian alliance makes itself felt most prominently on college campuses and in entertainment. Its causes include multiculturalism, the sexual revolution, curriculum diversification, and affirmative action based on identity rather than economic status. Such causes face opposition, which identitarians struggle to silence through political correctness. As they see it, policing speech and behaviors offensive to their constituents enhances study and work environments. It levels an economic, social, and intellectual playing field that has long been tilted in favor of whites, men, and heterosexuals. In the 2010s, political correctness shifted emphasis from suppressing hate speech targeted at its constituents to creating safe spaces that shelter them from discomforting acts and expressions. The task requires curbing microaggressions, which are intrinsically trivial acts that cause unintentional harm. Examples include a smile perceived as an affront, a question treated as an act of exclusion, boredom attributed to stereotyping, and an idea treated as insensitivity. Microaggressions can be limited by issuing trigger warnings whenever a topic potentially upsetting to an oppressed constituency is on the agenda. Consider an assignment to read a novel on the tribulations of an immigrant family. A trigger warning would let victims of anti-immigrant speech avoid the relevant content. The critics of identitarian political correctness consider it a system of oppression that shields unjust, inefficient, and even counterproductive identity-based policies from public scrutiny. It institutionalizes mistrust, intolerance, and hatred of others, they say, while hiding behind egalitarian slogans to create new bastions of privilege. In blocking frank and open discussion of identitarian agendas, political correctness also limits the exposure of identitarian intolerance. Identitarians respond that their rules of expression merely protect oppressed groups against hurt and aggression. As such, they amount not to intolerance, but to its negation. During the 2016 presidential campaign, identitarians heavily supported the Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. In itself, that fueled speculation that if elected, she would promote political correctness. She validated suspicions through a passing comment now remembered as the biggest gaffe of her campaign. The description of half of her opponent's supporters as a basket of deplorables. Her wording dehumanized tens of millions of Americans. She was taken to mean that in addition to rejecting the policy positions of her opponent's supporters, she despised their values and lifestyles. In other words, the characterization aligned her with political correctness while epitomizing its widely despised intolerance. By energizing her opponents, the comment may well have cost her the close election. Conservative and nativist intolerance. The appearance of the political correctness concept reflected resistance to the agenda that it was meant to advance. Loose-knit coalitions opposed to identitarian causes were forming, many centered in conservative churches. Televangelists such as Oral Roberts, Jerry Falwell, and Pat Robertson, and talk radio hosts such as Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, were ringing alarm bells about the prevailing social and political trends. The most worrying transformations involved feminism, abortion, affirmative action, drug abuse, growth in government, environmental regulation, and restrictions on religious practices. On these issues, TV networks, leading newspapers, government agencies, career politicians in Washington and state capitals, the higher education community, Hollywood, and labor unions all tended to be on the wrong side. They had united behind family-weakening, secularizing, repressive, and immoral policies inimical to the fabric of American society. In the mid-1990s, Fox News, a new cable network, became this opposition's face on television. Fox News also championed the interests of business, including both small and large enterprises. Hence, it helped to sustain the political alliance at the core of the Republican Party, that between economic and political conservatism. No such alliance is free of tension. On any given matter, constituents may have conflicting goals. In this case, the coalition proved sustainable for a while as the Republican Party's electoral fortunes waxed and waned. Big business interests paid lip service to Republican cultural goals, and cultural conservatives put up with economic policies favoring mega corporations and wealthy individuals. The advent of the Tea Party movement following the 2008 presidential election was the first sign of a serious split. The Tea Party charged the Republican leadership with hidden political correctness. It also focused attention on the shared interests of the Democratic Party leadership, which has tended to represent highly educated voters, and the big money wing of the Republican Party. Donald Trump's political surge owes much to his unprecedented ability to mesmerize the media through outrageous behavior and insults. But also critical was his savvy exploitation of tensions within the two-party system. His candidacy for the Republican nomination proved a huge outlet for the anger of constituencies that have done relatively poorly in recent decades. It gave them hope as he railed against both Democrats and Republicans, who benefit disproportionately from rapid technological change and advancing globalization. They succeeded, he said, by rigging the system in their favor. In the eyes of his followers, such political rhetoric legitimized demonization of the bipartisan establishment. The passions that Trump aroused are apparent in video clips of his campaign rallies. His fans waited for hours just to hear him speak in person. What the Trump administration gives to his supporters, apart from rhetoric and bravado, remains to be seen. His naming of a billionaire Pat cabinet suggests that, on the economic front, his supporters will be disappointed, as does the initial half-year of his term. What is certain is that Trump supporters feel more empowered to speak their minds, and also to intimidate, silence, and chase away people whom they consider misguided. Just as conservatives feel the need to speak cautiously on university campuses known for identitarian activism, so in distressed towns that voted heavily for Trump self-identified progressives know that the climate of opinion is hostile to their own viewpoints. Some Trump supporters are willing to pursue extra legal means for achieving their objectives. The Charlottesville demonstration of August 12, 2017 provides an illustration. The marchers included armed white supremacist groups. In the eyes of such supporters, Trump has legitimized lawbreaking through his diatribes against the establishment rigged system. He has done so also by flaunting the law routinely, whether in ignoring conflicts of interest, inviting Russia to interfere with American elections, questioning the loyalty of immigrant citizens, or dismissing external commitments of the United States. Just as political correctness demonizes its detractors as racist, misogynist, and homophobic, so Trump's crowds disparage his critics as un-American and crooked. Supporters of nation-building abroad, free trade, and amnesty for undocumented aliens should all be treated with disdain. And they are all the more deserving of opprobrium insofar as they exhibit political correctness. Throughout his campaign, Trump lambasted political correctness as a cancer destroying America and promised to fight it. Friend or foe, everyone in his audiences knew what he meant. He would not coddle undeserving minorities, put foreigners ahead of Americans, or keep the United States in trade treaties that ship jobs abroad. He would not cozy up to Hollywood bosses, whose products rarely show evangelicals or conservative whites, in a positive light. Furthermore, in reversing established social policies, he would remind America-hating elites that most Americans reject their values. There is no widely accepted name for the intolerance of the movement centered around Trump. Trumpism sees use, but so does the new political correctness, patriotic correctness, and populist correctness. Nativist intolerance offers the advantage of conveying the movement's emphasis on putting America first. Like political correctness, this is a descriptor concocted by a critical outsider. Its practitioners overlap with conservatives who practice conservative correctness. Their attitudes come in many shades. My nomenclature represents an analytical shorthand that sets aside many nuances. Mutually reinforcing intolerances. Interactions among the rival intolerances are complicated by the fact that neither situates itself along the traditional left-right axis. They are at odds, above all, over the primary axis of conflict in the United States. For identitarians, the fundamental conflict is between groups defined by ethnicity, race, gender, sexual orientation, and citizenship status, factors generally determined at birth. Nativists reject the focus on identity as artificial. For them, the principal fault line of American society runs between ordinary folk, by far the majority, and elites, who control the levers of power. America needs policies that put America first, they say, without slicing Americans into hyper-selfish constituencies. If the mantra of the identitarians is justice for minorities, that of nativists is making America great again. Basic disagreement over what needs discussion limits communication between the two sides. It also makes it easier for each to treat the other as deranged, if not subhuman. Identitarians see the nativist agenda as a reaction to privileges slipping away, as another gasp to undo whatever progress the country has made toward equalizing rights and opportunities across genders, ethnic and racial groups, sexual classifications, and citizenship categories. It proves that the struggle for justice will be long and painful, as they have said all along. The extent of the reaction shows that massive work is required just to maintain the gains of the past half century. The intimidations endured by undocumented immigrants testify to the dangers to minorities, as do mosque burnings, the prevalence of rape, police violence against African Americans, and rules meant to suppress voting by non-whites. The persistence of these dangers proves the wisdom of censoring sexist, racist, and nationalist expression. They reconfirm that when speech is poorly monitored, offensive discourses spread like cancer. Identitarian intolerance thus derives vitality, even purpose, from nativist intolerance. The big boost that nativists receive from Trump's presidency has energized identitarians as well. For their part, the nativists depend on identitarian activism. Without identitarian policies or associated political correctness, they would be attributing their misfortunes mainly to technology, trade, and immigration. These are all factors resolvable through bargaining within the left-right political spectrum. The identitarian agenda infuriates them by privileging the problems of groups from which they are mostly, if not totally, excluded. An American-born heterosexual white male minor fits none of the victim categories of the identitarians. As he sees it, universities, the mass media, Hollywood, government agencies, and the nonprofit sector ignore his own problems and they do so because the identitarian worldview blinds them to all but a sliver of human suffering. Adding insult to injury, identitarians also look down at him as uneducated, superstitious, and unpolished, as an inferior creature who does not deserve a hearing. The identitarians may also consider him a villain merely because of his innate persona. Some think that he cannot be a victim of anything, because he belongs to groups that define the establishment. His woes merit no sympathy, identitarians may say, because they represent retribution for past discrimination. Positions on each side harden, then, because of the other's reactions. Perceived indifference to deep grievances fuels anger, which then undermines empathy for others. An ambitious teenager from a poor family in America's Rust Belt perceives that the academic establishment is more welcoming to immigrants than to underprivileged Americans like himself. The resulting anger keeps him from appreciating the challenges of being an undocumented college student in the age of Trump. The sense that one cannot speak honestly in milieus dominated by a rival intolerant group leads to disengagement from the problems of others. Imagine a small town bar that tolerates anti-gay slurs. The atmosphere makes a gay visitor conceal his sexual identity and keep quiet during a political discussion. That discomforting experience then makes him insensitive to evangelical concerns about declining religious freedoms. Consider, finally, a college student who planned to attend an event featuring a conservative speaker. The speaking invitation is withdrawn under threats of violence from identitarian activists. The episode makes him lose interest in a course on feminist literature. In all such cases, ordinarily equitable people end up embracing double standards. They start denying to groups that they perceive as unsympathetic and insensitive, if not also hostile, rights that they readily grant to members of their own groups. They become intolerant because of others' intolerance. The political system can reinforce the illustrated polarization. For one thing, polarized voters are more likely to nominate extreme candidates and to take the trouble to vote. For another, politicians whose career success depends on pleasing an extreme constituency are less likely to make compromises. Polarized politicians inflame animosities between citizen blocs that scarcely communicate with one another. Legitimizing intransigence, they also strengthen the logic for pressing one's own causes and dismissing those of the other side. Institutional devices designed to tilt the political playing field, such as gerrymandering and voter registration restrictions, can complement these effects, partly by narrowing the voter base that the politicians feel obligated to serve, but also by fueling perceptions of partisan mischief. Availability chambers as reinforcers of intolerance. In a polarized environment, people do not willingly step into situations that subject them to rancor. To pick up earlier illustrations, a gay visitor would rather spend time among people who accept his identity, and a student seeking a well-rounded education would rather attend a college hospitable to open-ended political debate. In an ideal world, the menu of options would be sufficiently broad to present gay visitors and college students ideal choices in every possible encounter. Alas, the choices can be quite limited. Some American towns have no gay-friendly bars at all. Most research universities of the United States have student groups who will kick up a storm if an invitation goes out to a speaker whom they find offensive. Many other settings allow Americans to avoid views, attitudes, and even people whom they find offensive. Cities offer gays abundant opportunities to relax in an LGBTQAI-friendly environment. At least after freshman year, college students can pick compatible roommates. In certain walks of life, then, Americans can sort themselves into groups of like-minded, mutually respecting people. If they so choose, They can socialize only with people who are comfortable with political differences. By the same token, if they are intolerant themselves, they can self-select into suitably prejudiced social and professional groups. Such groups of politically like-minded people form communication networks, known as echo chambers. The concept refers to surroundings that amplify and reinforce our ideas, beliefs, and information through constant repetition. Idealized Tocquevillian communities served as echo chambers, insofar as their members reinforced each other's worldviews through repeated references, often implicit. These worldviews encompassed perceived facts about African-American abilities, the effects of smoking, and the origins of the human species. Availability chambers is a superior descriptor, because within groups of like-minded individuals, the reinforcement process involves more than exchanging ideas. Understandings get reinforced through a combination of communal and social pressures. Ideas acceptable to the group get echoed both because many people share them and because members with doubts refrain from speaking honestly. The joint effect of these two mutually reinforcing processes is that ideas the group appears to deem acceptable become increasingly available in its public communications. The flip side of the high availability of acceptable ideas is the low availability of what is unacceptable. In concentrating their members' attention on acceptable ideas, availability chambers limit their exposure to conflicting facts and arguments. The concept of availability chambers harkens to availability cascade, which is a self-reinforcing process of collective belief formation. Under an availability cascade, an expressed perception triggers a chain reaction that gives that perception increasing plausibility through its rising availability in public discourse. The process is intermediated by the availability heuristic, a pervasive mental shortcut through which the perceived likelihood of any given event depends on the ease with which its occurrences can be brought to mind. Cognitive psychologists find that individual beliefs regarding truth and falsehood are generally based on the ease with which pertinent examples come to mind. That ease depends on the relative availability of evidence pointing in one direction or the other. Availability chambers are particularly visible online. Facebook users select their own friends, and Twitter users choose whom to follow. Such social media are conducive, then, to intolerant communities forming and reinforcing their worldviews. People who consider immigrants the source of unemployment interact within chambers consisting of immigration opponents. For their part, people worried about anti-immigrant discrimination self-select into chambers of immigration supporters. Within each chamber, different aspects of the issue get communicated and amplified. Different myths get concocted, elaborated, and disseminated, and different entities get demonized. Unsurprisingly, public opinion research finds that online social networks are associated with political polarization. The same research shows also that online networks boost exposure to materials from their less preferred side of the political spectrum. Though counterintuitive within the analytical framework of an echo chamber, this is entirely plausible once we recognize that intolerant Americans self-select into availability chambers. Members of availability chambers do not simply pass on information about favored policies. They also inform their members about the other side's machinations. To that end, they repost communications of their opponents, but selectively, in order to heighten the sense of clear and present danger. Thus, news about violence by white supremacists goes viral in identitarian circles, and nativist circles explode with outrage whenever a conservative speaker is prevented from speaking on some campus. In each case, vast numbers of people are held responsible for the excesses of a few. Members of availability chambers do not simply distort reality by communicating information selectively. They also teach their members to express outrage at the messages of opponents, to despise people with different opinions, and to shame anyone, especially insiders, who might dare to suggest that something in a rival position is worth considering. Teaching members to hate the other side requires communicating information about what opponents are trying to accomplish. In sum, online political networks are not only censoring agents that truncate exposure to political information, they serve also as outrage machines that intimidate and punish anyone who questions their dogma or seems inclined to see some merit in opponents' positions. But in censoring and intimidating, they do not keep their members ignorant about the goals of opponents. Rather, they give their members exaggerated and unrepresentative impressions of rival agendas. Insofar as availability chambers keep views from being heard, they constrain their own members' access to information. Like offline intolerant communities, their online counterparts are agents of illiberalism toward both outsiders and insiders. Tensions exist within every network of every intolerant community. No two network members will have identical needs or perspectives. Differences are easy to spot within both nativist and identitarian networks. For instance, the interests of African Americans at the bottom of the labor market conflict with those of unskilled new immigrants who depress wages. And in extinguishing low-tech jobs, trade treaties benefit job-losing constituencies through cheaper industrial goods. Intolerant communities deal with such complexities by discouraging their exposure. As within any coalition, whether based on a shared heritage, a shared environment, or a shared political agenda, participants are expected to overlook inconsistencies among the goals of individual members. True, their subcommunities will enjoy some discretion in prioritizing selected elements of the favored policy package, provided they pay lip service to the community's unity and accept its core principles and goals. They may tailor their positions to special needs. Feminists often include African-American men among the victimizers of American women. Likewise, the proponents of racial justice commonly hold the white majority responsible for racial discrimination. Nevertheless, feminists and racial activists maintain harmony within the grand identitarian coalition. They do so by focusing their animus on their common adversaries whenever they join forces. If one requirement for membership in an intolerant community is shared goals, another is participation in the shaming of villains. That is one reason why so much of their internal discussions convey loathing, and why online networks tied to an intolerant community seldom produce constructive ideas for resolving differences peacefully. Network members are expected to enforce their intolerance by persecuting compromisers and by stigmatizing them as ignorant, misguided, selfish, dangerous, and immoral. Failing to display outrage at violators or neglecting to punish them through denial of opportunities can cast doubt on one's own intolerance. Members must display hate toward compromisers to prove their own credentials. Consider the identitarian view that discrimination is a core reason for victimization and marginalization. For an intolerant identitarian who subscribes to this worldview, inviting a scholar who focuses on self-destructive behaviors would amount to enabling a campaign to blame the victim. For intolerant nativists, likewise, gun control of any sort is anathema. Letting someone make a case for banning assault weapons would amount to rewarding a liberal bent on extinguishing the American way of life. The villains here are elites who make streets unsafe through softness on crime and policies responsible for social dysfunction. Such elites must be demonized, along with anyone who seeks to legitimize the liberal agenda. Loss of expressive freedoms has become a growing source of concern in the United States. The opponents of identitarian policies complain about rules and pressures that hinder honest discourse, and the opponents of nativist policies have analogous grievances. Yet people tend to worry specifically about losing their own voices, not about threats to expressive liberty generally. When identitarian campus activists block a conservative speaker, protests come mostly from conservatives and nativists of various stripes. Similarly, when President Trump bars questions from fake news media, objections come largely from groups that voted against him. Moreover, neither side pays much attention to expressive restrictions within its own camp. Yet these restrictions play a key role in turning public discourses into hysterical melees. The internal exchanges of political communities hide complexities, nuances, and variations. They tend to turn ranges of similar views into a single position immune to compromise. Just as a gun rights advocate may also believe in banning the private ownership of assault rifles, so a supporter of affirmative action may believe that without income thresholds, its benefits will go primarily to already privileged applicants. However, for fear of reprisals from their own political soulmates, both will self-censor. Hiding their private preferences and private knowledge about their group's agenda, they will pretend to share its public consensus. No political network forms an assembly whose members evaluate evidence, weigh the pros and cons of policies, and make reasoned trade-offs in the manner of a collegial research workshop, certainly not if its defining traits include intolerance. Preference and knowledge falsification distort public perceptions of the inclinations and thoughts of their members. They make the typical group member look more homogeneous, more rigid, angrier, and more hateful than in reality. A byproduct of concealing doubts and differences is ignorance. Within intolerant networks, falsified communications leave other members in the dark about possible solutions to social problems, or even about the existence of certain problems themselves. In other words, they truncate the public availability of knowledge concerning passionately defended policies. Impoverishing public discourses, they hinder the identification and execution of viable responses to social troubles, and in the process, they aggravate the very intolerances that inhibit honest communication in the first place. Participants in politically extreme online networks often have normal interactions offline. In fact, most Americans who belong to hate-spewing networks regularly visit mainstream news outlets such as CNN, CBS News, and USA Today. They thus get exposed to diverse perspectives firsthand. They do not avoid news sites that cover complexities, present bigger pictures, aim for balanced reporting, and feature commentators who appreciate the conflicts among widely held principles of morality. Exposure to contrary opinions does not make an extremist politically neutral. Judging by the internet searches of participants in extreme online networks, the recipients of mainstream news remain sympathetic, in one degree or another, to positions associated with extremism. Within their online availability chambers, they take positions that their mainstream news sources characterize as extreme. In other words, they take on a radicalized persona. Once again, this radicalization is not simply a matter of developing extreme ideas. The process is not limited to turning a potentially nuanced communal discourse over competing priorities into rigid and absolute claims about public policy. It also involves heightened intolerance of contrary views. It entails the harassment, shaming, and demonization of people who convey reservations about agendas treated as beyond compromise. Hatred triumphant. Intolerant communities are never satisfied with sharing political power. Precisely because they despise their opponents, they want to drive them out of public spaces, if not to wipe them out. Comments such as, "I'm glad he got shot," referring to a political assassination attempt, convey the extremes that intolerance can reach. Picket signs such as, "Death penalty for fags," offer another grisly example. Intolerant communities also seek to win over people with moderate views, especially those who see matters from multiple perspectives and favor compromises. Through a combination of repression and conversion, they try to expand their social presence, salience, and influence. By no means is success guaranteed. First of all, rival intolerant communities limit each other's influence by publicizing the other side's incivility and destructiveness. Thus, identitarian communities have framed the Breitbart News Network as a source of malicious stories and destructive policies far outside of mainstream American conservatism. Likewise,